Ohio Lead Free Kids Coalition, a collection of organizations and individuals who share a deep and urgent concern about the potentially lifelong harm caused by lead poisoning. If you are interested in learning more about OHHN or joining our network, please check out our website at OHHN.org. If you are interested in claiming continuing education credits for today's webinar attendance, please email Philip Boughton at pbouton@columbus.gov. And I'll spell that very quickly for you, pbouton@columbus.gov. In the email, please include your full name, REHS number, and that you attended today's webinar. We will also provide the CE information towards the end of the webinar as a reminder. In addition to our webinars, OHHN hosts an annual conference that will be held on April 18th, 2025. So please save that date. Again, April 18th. The 2025 conference theme is Housing as a Safe Space, Creating Healthier Communities. OHHN will also be requesting proposals and poster ideas from professionals across the state for the 2025 conference. Make sure to check out our website for more information. Finally, one last housekeeping item. This webinar is being recorded and it will be uploaded to the OHHN website at a later date. Now, I would like to introduce our presenter. We are very lucky to have with us today Scott Armour, an environmental and occupational health specialist with over 30 years of experience, who focuses in industrial hygiene with special expertise in contamination and exposure assessment, project design, and management. Scott, we are so happy to have you here today joining us and being able to share all of this wonderful information. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Carrie, for that great introduction. I really look forward to this. It looks like we have a great audience in a group of attendees. I'm recognizing names as I'm scrolling through, so I welcome those of you who I know. It's a very, very pleasant feeling to have all these people attend here. We talked about having this for a while, and we had no idea what our outreach was going to be and what the attendance was going to be, so we're very pleased with this, and thank you for spending your time with us. The goal today is to make you aware that there's a document out there that is accepted worldwide and is going to help you do mold remediation. If you have any questions, we're going to have time for questions and answers. Please put those in the chat. We're going to take breaks throughout to catch up on questions in case there's a group of similar questions based on a certain topic. And then at the very end, we do have time reserved just for question and answer. We're pressed for time, as everybody is. So I don't think we're going to be able to run past the scheduled time. I don't think we have enough IT support to be able to do that. Please feel free to put in there topics you'd like to hear me talk about or something you want me to focus on if you haven't heard it halfway through the presentation. I have to speak a little bit for myself for a quick moment. I was involved in writing this document. I was actually involved in the very first version. What I'm going to do is I'm going to have two different presentations today. One is a summary of the basics of what is this thing called S520, and the other is the actual 520. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to pull up a highlighted version of the document so you can see what it is. And just to show you all, it actually exists as a book. For some reason, hang on, videos are cut off, but anyways, it does exist as a book, and it exists online. So I'm going to switch over to this document right here. And whoops, that's not where it's supposed to be. That should work. Sorry about that. I have a conflict be on my screen between Zoom and the pictures I'm seeing. So there we go. The formal title is exactly what it says. And there's letters and words up there, ANSI, ICRC, S520, the year 2024. So this document, this is the fourth edition. It was 2003, 2008, 2015, and now finally 2024. The letters ICRC is the organization that is the standard writing organization. They are accredited by ANSI, American Na National Standards Institute, to write standards. When we talk about standards, we talk about things like consensus. This is an industry consensus. Industry professionals are brought in from all around the world, and they come together and they provide what together they provide what they think is a proper way to do something. ANSI provides us a certain level of accreditation and quality in what we do. It's credible. It's not just a bunch of guys sitting around on a weekend smoking cigars, drinking scotches, and saying, hey, the five of us came up with a thing. We're going to call it consensus and we're going to publish it. This is truly what's going on in the industry. Some people define a standard of care as the history or the moment it was published. That's what's happening. It is not best practices. It's not state of the art. It is what is supposed to be done by the typical remediator. In this case, oh, sorry, I jumped ahead. Here's the two people who were in charge of this thing. I was vice chair. Jim Pearson was our chair. The document, we essentially provided the direction and moderation of all the members that contributed to it to make sure things were fair and open and properly debated and chosen before they went into the document. ICRC writes other standards. This is not the only thing they wrote. And again, I mentioned this is because they are ANSI accredited as a standards producer. And here's some examples. I'm not here to sell that, but I just wanted to give you an example the mold standard is not alone in what they do. Everybody wants to know what standard of care is. We say, did you follow the standard of care? There's the definition. This is straight from the 520. This has been reviewed by many people. It's compared to legal definitions and Webster's definitions. And so these are practices that are common to prudent members, reasonably prudent members of the trade. And they're qualified and competent. So we expect these people have been trained, educated, experienced. They've come up with a way that works. And they bring that expertise, that knowledge, and together as a group, this document is what was the result of that. And I think that's really important to remember because every time you look at this document or pull a section out of it, or you quote it, or you ask somebody to do it, you are really asking them, did you, when you say, did you follow the standard of care? Do you abide by the standard of care? You're literally asking them, are you a reasonably prudent member of the trade? And are you recognized somehow as being qualified and competent? And we expect that from them. So it helps us when we're preparing our work, whether we're writing contracts, issuing payments, whether we're doing an inspection or assessment, whether we're asked by somebody to make their home healthier and safer. Obviously, a lot of you are somehow working with Ohio Healthy Homes. That's what we're asking them. And we should be able to get an answer for that. Just throw something out there for those of you who've used the 520 before and thought, hey, this is the new version. What's the difference? And do I have to buy both versions? Do I have to buy one version? They did come out with a version this time for the first time, and it's called the redline version. Other organizations offer this when they edit a standard or a reference guide. And that way you can compare what was there before to what is there now. So I'm just putting that there. It's an interesting way to be able to look at things. So if you don't own the 2015 version, and some of your contractors or your contacts or the people working for you keep referencing the 2015, you can purchase this and you can see why there is or is not a difference between what they are providing now, because they're used to following the 2015, and what we can expect from them now. Oh, and by the way, this document was published several months ago, so it is very new. It is unlikely that most of the industry is aware of it. So if you're going to present this to somebody and say, I expect you to follow the ISARC S520 and you want the latest version, you're probably going to have to help them realize that this has been published. Tens of thousands of people use this around the world. So it's very difficult to get the word out that there's a new version out there. I'm going to throw this out there because I want you to realize how many people and where they came from participated in this. It's critical to understand what consensus is and what it means. So everybody's got their picture up there. And yes, Craig really is a pirate over there. He's out of Las Vegas, and I'm not really sure how pirate ship ended up in the middle of the desert, but he's a special provider of information. Mem right there in the middle, or off to the right-hand side, he's from Australia. And we always say we represent the entire world. Graham, the first person on the left there, Vancouver, Canada, up in British Columbia. So we bring in people, not just those people who work in the United States. Some more people, different specialists. Everybody has a different role out there. Bert manages buildings and facilities. Tom Flood is a remediator. Mike McGinnis is like myself. He's an industrial hygienist and health and safety professional. Cole is one of our industry's experts on biocides, coatings, and chemicals. So he's indispensable. Brad is like myself and Mike. So it's not just a bunch of contractors writing this. We bring in a variety of people to input. Dave was our specialist on insurance matters, so that was critical. Pictures of mold, just to remind you what we're looking at. Don't forget, this is all about mold. The scope, pretty straightforward. Procedures and precautions when performing mold remediation. The small print underneath highlights that it's for any building, residential, commercial, institutional. So you can use this for schools, you can use police departments, libraries, high rises, mid rises, standalones, duplexes, whatever it is you want to do, this applies. I think that's important because a lot of people look at one document and they say, oh, this was written for schools and commercial buildings, like from EPA. This one is written for those, but it's also written for a single family home as well. So it's applicable across any structure where people are occupants. This is just a quick list of anybody who might find this useful. It's probably three or four of these bullets are who's in our attendance today. I don't know if we have any insurance company representatives out there, but for example, why would you want an insurance company person? Well, they're doing the underwriting. They're doing the review of the project, right? We have these people out there telling us we can or can't do something. Sometimes we have third-party assessors looking at projects. So government regulators, do they want to copy this and bring this into their regulations? Do they want to compare it to their regulations? I talked about this already, covers all types of buildings. There's a great picture of some of that nasty black mold that we see out there. Some of the cool pink mold, some of the green mold that makes people sicker quicker. Incredible destruction. Sadly, right now with the hurricane and the floods, there's going to be a lot of people out there across a lot of this United States that are going to be needing mold specialists to take a look at their buildings. There's a lot of sections to the 520, just highlights that you can look at almost anything except for assessment, but you can look at inspections, you can look at HVAC, you can look at contents, and we've made comment on it. We've provided you a way to do it. So just some interesting pictures. We've summarized the changes from the 2015. And for those of you who use the 2015, if you've attended because this is the new version, real quickly, we focused a little bit differently on insurance coverage. So we gave you some new updated information on insurance, which is critical for doing the work. It's also critical for those people hiring a remediation company. So if you're going to hire a contractor, we now can point out to them what kind of insurance we expect them to have so that as the client, we are protected. A lot of definitions have been changed and added. So we're going to cover that in a little bit. We picked out this word mycotoxins because mycotoxins is, without a doubt, for the last 4 or 5 years, the hot button in mold. There's pr not a place that I go, person I talk to, a remediator I meet, that doesn't say what I got to learn about mycotoxins. They're telling me I need to remove the mycotoxins. Can you remove the mycotoxins? So we address that. We specifically and intentionally address that. And I think that's going to be critical to all of you out there using this. Many of you have heard that term. Many of you heard the term black toxic mold, deadly toxic mold. We've addressed that. We've never addressed that in the past. We didn't cross over into being a health document, but we did recognize that there are constituents, particles that contain these things called mycotoxins or other components of mold that can affect health and that remediators and assessors are identifying and removing. This may be a first for this type of document. There are others out there who have their own kind of internal methods. You don't have to rely on that anymore. You don't have to use a proprietary method that only that contractor's company provides. You can come here to an independent consensus document and say, we're going to follow this document to remove these types of problems in the building. We focused on biocides. Again, we've always focused on biocides. We brought it up to date a little bit more. And really, this is due to the industry's focus on the use of chemicals, on the use of products. So we have a lot of people out there selling and convincing people that they have a magic oil, they have a magic spray, they have a special product, and it gets rid of mold, it gets rid of mycotoxins. We focus on that. We have language in here now that addresses that so that as a user, as a person that's hiring a contractor, you're not getting taken to the bank. And that may sound cynical right now, but the world's become a cynical place, and we need to know we're buying the right thing and we're doing the right thing. It's a matter of the chemical going into the building and getting the bad stuff, the mold, out of the building. We talked a little bit about stain removers separate from biocides. We really emphasize the language or improve the language on deviating from the standard of care. And I'll talk about that a little bit later. But one of the things we remember about the standard of care, it's voluntary. This is a voluntary standard of care. It is not written into part of the law. And we get that question all the time. Fred and I talked about that yesterday. What's the law in Ohio, for example, versus the law in Florida or New York or Texas or California? Most of you are from Ohio, and obviously our sponsor, Ohio Healthy Homes, is all about Ohio. In Ohio, we have no rules, no laws, no regulations with regard to mold. There's no public health rule out there with regard to mold. The closest they come in the public health realm in the state of Ohio is nuisance. I'm not going to get into that now, but please know if you hear someone telling you they're licensed in the state of Ohio for mold, that doesn't exist. There is no such thing as a state-granted license. If you hear someone telling you, oh, we have to follow the law, there is no law in Ohio with regard to mold or remediation or assessment or sampling. And there's no federal law that applies to us either. I'm going to pause a moment and let that sink in. There's no law. There's no regulation. So we have to be able to go somewhere to figure out what to do and what's responsible to do. This document is what it is. This is why this was written in 2003, and this is why it's had three different updates, and we're on the fourth edition. We then talk about relationship between contractors and IEPs. IEPs, for those of you who've not heard that phrase before, that sometimes is referred to as a hygienist, an industrial hygienist, a mold tester, the guy down the street who can take a mold sample, indoor environmental professional. We're going to talk about that a little bit later too. It is well defined in this document, and so it kind of has a dual purpose. It's a generic term out there in the industry. A lot of adjusters use that term. Insurance adjusters, we talked about insurance a moment ago. They'll be using that term. A lot of remediators will tell you, oh, I need an IEP to do that. And we'll talk about that later. From the very first edition in 2000, way back in 2003, and it never went away, was this last bullet item called post-remediation evaluation. I'm going to show you what that means. We went through this, and I'll show you as we go, and we really focus on what that means and whose responsibility that is. So that's a quick list. You're going to get a video of this before, later, so you're going to be able to have that and pull that up and take a look at it. I'm going to switch the screens right now. If Fred, if anybody's thrown out a question, I'm not following the chat, by the way, so I'm not seeing the questions. Fred Strayhorn from Ohio Healthy Homes is going to help me do that. So if any relevant questions pop up, this is a good time for Fred to go ahead and help
As of
me out
yet, we
with
don't have
that.
a question about anything you've said, yet, Scott.
So you can still see my screen, right? I didn't accidentally shut that off, did I?
Scott, we can still see your screen.
Perfect. And I'm trying to, here we go. This is what I'm shooting for. So we're going to switch over. This is the document. This is what
Scott,
you can, I'm sorry, yes?
I think I do have a question. It's asking for clarification of the work plan development process to a should quotation marks progression with new record keeping requirements inspection by the restore preliminary determination by the restore assessment by an IEP only if needed restoration work plan and finally scope. So it was asking for a little bit of clarification on the plan development process.
So the way you read that, I'm not sure what the real question was. It brought up a lot of it brought up a lot of trigger or keywords on throughout the document, and I think I touch on every single one of those. So over the next, let's see, I'm checking the time. Over the next, I'm going to shoot for 45 minutes, and then that'll give us 20 minutes if we want to take separate. If I have to run a few minutes over, we're good. But it gives us that 15 to 25 minutes Q&A. So it's 12:25. Over the next 45 minutes, I'm going to touch on almost every single, I think actually every single one of those terms you just read in that question. So once again, there's the cover of the document dated 2024, fourth edition. And I'm not beating a dead horse here, but you cannot believe how many times I've asked somebody, do they follow the 520? And they say yes, and they pull up the 2008 edition. And we're long enough past 2015 that they should at least be pulling up to 2015 right now, but it is incumbent upon all of us who are going to require this or ask for it. They have to get the 2024 edition. And yes, sadly for everybody, you have to buy it. And again, I'm not here to sell it. I don't represent, I just want everyone to be clear. I didn't mention this earlier. I forgot. I apologize. I don't represent the ICRC. The consensus body that wrote this is considered independent, by the way. The ISCRC, like the board of directors, the president, the managers, the people who run and operate ISCRC for its regular work cannot influence the consensus body that wrote this. And that's one of the requirements from ANSI. So when ANSI says if you're going to be a producer, if we're going to accredit your organization to produce standards, they have to agree to allow the consensus body to be independent. And that's super critical because somebody sitting on the board might not like what we wrote about chemicals. They're selling chemicals. They don't want us to limit the use of chemicals. Well, too bad for them because the consensus of the industry says, here's how you use a chemical and when you should or should not. That's just one of 100 examples. So when we ask them to pull this up, we're not just asking them to buy something from the ICRC. And I'm not, I don't, I can't make money off the ICRC, right? I'm completely separate. Everyone who wrote this, by the way, those pictures I showed you, everyone was a volunteer and worked for free. So that's a big difference too, because I can show you a document that tells you how to clean mold and it's sold and the money goes to the author. You know, I'm the vice chair of this thing. I had a great deal of input on this, as the other 14 people that I showed you photos of. We don't get paid every time this is sold. No royalties, nothing. And I think that's critical, right? Because it's a fair, honest, open document. And there's all our dates right there on the bottom of the page. And so essentially what I'm going to do is just I'm going to scroll through this as if you and I were sitting at a table and I was going to just page through it and give you a quick overview of the document. There's all our sections. You can see, as I showed you before.
Scott, I'm going to have to interrupt you. I'm not seeing the document that you are mentioning on the screen. I'm just seeing the thank you slide.
Well, that's not supposed to be there. Holy crap. Let me find where do I have to? Oh, do I have to stop share and share again? Oh, there it is. New share. Sorry. Well, there you go, everybody. This is what you missed. How's that?
Looks good. Thank you.
You know what I'm looking for? I don't want to goof this up. Is this my. No. I'm looking for the button on here that takes me to nothing but the. I want to get rid of this stuff. Like I said, I got too much. I apologize. I have too much overlap. I don't want you to see the ribbon. And y'all probably can see what I'm trying to do here. There we go. I think that works, right? Yeah. All right. So this is, I just showed you the page here. I scrolled through, and fortunately, somebody caught me before I continued. So I didn't mean that. I apologize to y'all. So one of the ways this document works and the standards in from ISCRC work is that we have what we call trigger words. So when you're reading this document, no matter where you're at, you're going to see the words shall, should, recommend. And it's a little bit different than other documents. So bear with me for a moment. And when we read this, or when you purchase this and read it, or when you take an excerpt or quote it, or someone else quotes it, realize these words mean something unique to the ICRC. So shall, and I'll zoom in on that, is used only when it's mandatory because it's a regulatory requirement. It's law. So you shall follow the EPA regulation, or it's a natural law. You shall fall off a roof due to gravity. We only use it for that purpose. So in here, wherever you see shall, it means it's a law. When we say should, this is non-negotiable. It's not an option. It's not like, oh, if it's a good idea, you should do this. When we write it, it's non-negotiable. This is the true shall in this book. This is the true must. You must do something. And that's going to apply later. We're going to talk a little bit about deviation and limitations. And so remember what I'm saying about the word should. And you could do things, and we've done this before, other people have done this. You could, go and do a global highlight and find all the shoulds. We can scroll down a little bit here, and I can highlight this. You can go look for all the recommends. So the recommend is it's suggested. The recommend is what I said. It's a good idea. It's a good idea. We recommend you do this. But you have an op as a contractor, you have an option. Now, please don't get me wrong. Later on, you may be asked to justify why you did or didn't do something that was recommended, right? So if you choose to do something other than what's recommended, I recommend strongly, and I'm sure an attorney who's working with you in your contracts and your liability and risk management is going to also urge you to be able to justify why you didn't do what was recommended. Obviously, if it's a should, again, non-negotiable, you must do it. And we'll talk about how to get out of doing something that's a should later. May and can, just kind of simple things. One is permissive and one is possible, just like what, your mom used to tell you, may I go outside, or can I go outside? Yes, you can, but I'm not letting you go out the door. So there is a difference there. The scope and the purpose, we talked about this a little bit briefly, and the other side assumes that determining and correcting the underlying cause of mold contamination. So I'm going to talk about this in a second also with regard to principles, but notice, and I highlighted this early because Fred asked about this yesterday when he and I were talking. If you notice, the underlying cause is the responsibility of the property owner. And that's because water causes mold growth. So this is not an intro to mold class. But just to remind everybody, the reason there's mold is because of moisture. Moisture is water. It comes in the liquid form or vapor form. So the remediator who's remediating and removing that mold, it's not part of his responsibility. The owner, the person who's issuing the contract, who is paying the remediator, has that responsibility. And I think that'll be a little bit more clear in just a second here. I'm going to jump around a little bit right now. I'm going to go from definitions. I'm going to zoom by this and you can see the different highlights here. And I'm going to jump to this very first section, the first chapter, so to speak. And you'll hear me when I'm out there working, I'll say, hey, did you abide by the principles of mold remediation? And we have five principles of mold remediation. Inevitably, when we are talking with remediators and we're doing assessments or we're doing clearances, a lot of you are from the lead remediation industry and you're used to hearing the word clearance. Hey, is the job done? The fourth principle is the one we talk about the most, but there are five principles. One is it should be the obvious one, but it's because of the health of the workers and the occupants. We wouldn't be here if mold didn't have health effects. And so we have to protect our workers and we have to protect our occupants. And for the purpose of this document, they're lumped in as one. So this also becomes critical when we're doing quality control or we're doing site visits. Are they protecting the occupants, right? Because we're usually responsible for the building or the occupants. So the person we're paying, the remediator, has to protect us, so to speak. They have to protect the occupants, the tenants in our buildings. So that's that principle. So if their job doesn't protect it and they're following the S520, this is what holds them accountable for that. Safety of workers is a little bit stickier because that is an OSHA regulated thing. And those of us who hire a contractor, we can have a whole class on whether or not you're obligated to enforce protection of workers under OSHA rules. So usually we hand that off to the contractor and we, in the contractor or agreement, work agreement, we give them the whole responsibility of protecting their own workers. We'll protect ours. Documentation is very critical. So document the conditions and the work processes became one of the principles. And this has existed from the very first version way back in 2003. Under document, we have this little thing here in yellow, health issues. And I've highlighted something similar later. And I'm pointing this out because we live in a world right now and we work in an industry right now that most, if not nearly all, of our contractors are going to advise us on health. They're going to tell us. They're going to get rid of the bad stuff. Your house is going to be healthy when it's done. Oh, you have a health issue. I'll find the mycotoxins and help you. You're even going to see people who are selling and referring to themselves as SIRS relevant or SIRS aware. SIRS is one of the illnesses you can get. So all of a sudden, we have contractors that are telling you they're aware of the illness and they're going to help you. Well, we drew a line and we said, you know, there should be an appropriate professional involved if there's a health risk. If there's health issues and somebody's coming to you and saying, hey, I'm getting sick from the mold on the wall. I know it's making me sick. Or, hey, my doctor said the mold's making me sick. We should find somebody else in addition to, and they should be independent. They should be third party. Whether or not an IEP is questionable, few IEPs, indoor environmental professionals, are qualified to assess health risk, health exposure. So So we do say other appropriate professionals, and that might be an industrial hygienist. It could be a certified industrial hygienist or professional industrial hygienist. It could be an environmental health science specialist. So there's a few terms out there that are professionals, and they can do that for you. So we want to make sure that that third party independent professional who's going to assess the health is actually qualified to do that. But this is, notice this is under the documentation. So they should be documenting, hey, they reported a health problem, and hey, we reached out, or we told you, the owner, we told somebody else, we need a third party in here to give us more information to make sure we do this right. Contamination control, the shortest of all the principles, and it's exactly what it said. Don't make a mess. Contamination control, prevent cross-contamination. That's the third principle. And then here's the fourth principle. And I said earlier, this is the one that we're going to talk about the most and that we're going to focus on. And the reason is because of the way the market is working right now. And over the last 5 years, we've seen this expand exponentially. And we have people selling us products that for some reason are magical. And we don't know why they're magical, but they promise us all sorts of things. It gets rid of the mold. It finds the mycotoxins. It destroys them. It makes them inert, whatever it is, whatever the sales pitch happens to be. And some of them will tell you it's proprietary. And that's exactly what their company was set up to do, was to sell you this special stuff, this special snake oil, the special chemistry. And you can say, you know what? We need someone who conforms to the S520. And they go, well, what's that mean? Or worse, they go, oh, we do follow the 520. And it'll be on their marketing materials. It'll be posted on the side of their van with a special wrap with cool flames and looks, pictures of floods on the side of the van. And they'll say, oh, we conform to the 520. And then they come in and they start spraying stuff and saying, oh, that's all we need to do. So we can hold their feet to the fire. We can say, sorry, fourth principle says physical removal. You have to physically remove. You have to clean the mold out. You have to take it away. There's no option here. It's a principle. And later on, it's always addressed with the trigger word should. This is a must. And we, as the people who are looking out there, we're putting out, maybe a request for proposals or something like that. We need to be able to follow these words and use these words. And then that way we know what we're getting is the correct thing. It also helps us compare apples to apples and apples to oranges when we're getting quotes. You know, we issue an RFP, we get 3-4 proposals and quotes and dollar amounts. And we now can look at the specs. We can look at their proposed specifications and materials. And we can see, are they really physically removing the mold? I'll look at contracts or proposals, I should say, and there's no labor. And I'm like, well, how can you physically remove this? You're charging me X number of dollars. You're selling me a biocide or a disinfectant or a fog. There's not enough labor in here to clean this building. So sometimes if you understand what the work process is and labor or time that it takes to do the job, you can figure out they're not really cleaning. They're not charging us correctly. And what means is they're not doing the mold remediation correctly. And then we very much clarify, and you can see I enlarge this. I don't want to anyone to be, we didn't want anyone to be confused. Attempts to kill, encapsulate, or inhibit mold are not adequate. That's really important. So we really helped you as the user be able to ferret out and be able to vet what the processes or the proposals that were being given to you were. And then contamination prevention, this goes back to what I mentioned earlier and said, whose responsibility is prevention. So we mentioned getting rid of water, and Fred and I talked about this. And so we are hiring a mold remediation company. They are not necessarily a water removal company. They're not a waterproof company. They're not a plumber. They're not a structural drying professional. So we may need to create a team when we're getting rid of mold or addressing mold. We may have to look at different layers and different problems and different solutions. And the mold remediation guy, the mold remediation company, is not, per this standard, is not responsible for that. So we have to be able to understand, when do they have to dry the building, before, during, or after the mold remediation? Can they do mold remediation when there is still water there? Can we come up with interim controls to manage the water so that we can remove the mold and continue to keep the building safe? So I have an answer to all those questions. We don't have time to go into that, but just know those are critical questions to be able to address Principle 5 contamination prevention. The document jumps right into antimicrobials, section two. And this is critical. It used to be the tools section. We talked a lot about different tools and equipment that you can use. And we really intentionally went out of our way to refocus this because we want to talk about chemicals. We want to talk about mold cleaners. Why? Because that's what the market's doing, right? Remember what I said, the standard of care is representation of what's happening in the market right now. And the market for the last 5 years has been pretty clear. People want to sell us chemicals. And removal and cleaning mold, the only chemical, I'm putting that in quotes, right? Because what is not a chemical? I don't want to get into that discussion. But the only chemical we need is soap and water. And that's super critical because you're going to hear words like, oh, you need to disinfect, or step five, we disinfect the property. I will never write a mold remediation specification that uses the word disinfect. It will not use antimicrobial, won't use disinfect, it won't use biocide, fungicide, none of that. Why? We're using detergents and we're using methods, whether they're vacuums or brushes or wipes or cloths, to remove the mold, or knives and saws to cut the moldy stuff out and throw it away. So there's a huge difference between those two concepts of doing the job. And if you don't take home anything from this, please take home the statement, we clean mold, we don't kill it. We don't need a disinfectant for mold. I can show you what kills mold, and I can show you chemicals and explain why, a quat, a phenol, a peroxide, a hypochlorite, why do these things kill or damage or affect the mold? But that's not our goal here. And the 520 clearly says that. And we are in alignment. This is a good point to bring up something. We are in alignment with the leading references. So the leading references that we use, that we can go to, the science that we can go to. There's several of these documents. And for those of you out there who are interested, for brevity, one is called the Green Book and one's called the Red Book. Although the Red Book now, there's an alternative, but bioaerosols from ACGIH and the Green Book from AIHA, absolutely critical. And we are in alignment with them. And if you look across the board to some of the proprietary one-off type recommendations, if you look to a company that tells you they have a method, what you're going to find is that they are not in alignment with those two documents or 100 others. And that's critical because they're saying we're just going to make this stuff up and we're going to do it our way. We don't care what the science says. This is not common sense stuff. We actually do need experts. And this document is brought to you by experts. I highlighted things that are going to sound like we're going to beat this to death. But we didn't give up on this. We put it everywhere throughout the documents. No liquor product should be used as an alternative to physical removal. Antimicrobials should not be relied upon to eliminate contaminants or allergenic or toxigenic properties. Notice toxigenic, that ties into the word mycotoxins. We helped you with coatings because a lot of people want to use these things called encapsulants. And you're going to some people sell that as a standard. You have to encapsulate. Well, we helped clarify when those are useful. We did talk a little bit about stain removers. Stain removers would be things like peroxides and hypochlorites, the things we call, quote, bleach. If you're going to use something to change the color, it should be addressed separately, and it should be addressed after you remediate. It's literally can be done by somebody else afterwards. It does not even have to be done by the remediator. I put this in red because this becomes part of the law. And I just want everyone to know that The products we are being sold or told are being used are registered. If they're intended to kill the stuff that we call mold, they're registered under EPA. So there's very strict rules for them. Again, we could do there's somebody might be in the audience. I saw two or three people signed up. I mean, in the list of attendees, between the three of us, we could give you 8 hours on chemicals and registration rules for what you can or can't use. We can give you an hour, 4 hours, 8 hours. So there's a lot that goes into that. And again, we were not short of our words. You should not use a disinfectant instead of remedium. You should not remove a, use a stain remover before cleaning the growth. We did add a new section called knockdown. This is important because there's a lot of people out there selling fogs, and they're going to say, "Hey, we have a special chemical. We're going to fog your whole building, whole place, and this fog's going to go everywhere, and it's going to do this, that, or the other thing." And we said, "Okay, we understand a lot about what fogging does, and it's been used for a lot of different purposes. But if we go back to what a very popular industry, asbestos, they use this thing called knockdown. Well, we can use it too." And we define that it's okay to use it, but you better do it right. So knockdown is we put a fog in there, and what it does is it attaches to all the particles that are floating in the air, and it weighs them down and either causes them to bump and stick more, or the liquid itself, the liquid fog sticks to the particle and they get heavy, and thanks to gravity, they fall. And the air becomes much, much cleaner. So we knock down the particles. However, what we see is people are selling this because it's so damn easy. "Oh, look, I can fog. See you later. Thanks for your $1,200. Have fun." Well, if you think about it, if they're telling us they're knocking down particulates that we don't want to breathe, what the heck happened to all those particles once they were out of the air? Oh, they fell to the earth. They fell to the table. They fell to the top of the kid's bed. They fell on top of the TV, on top of the countertop. Well, now what's going to happen? Well, the liquid is going to evaporate. And those particles that were wet an hour ago are starting to dry. And the more they dry, the lighter they get. And they're going to return to the air and you're going to breathe them again. And I'm going to bet you 90% of people who sell a fog to treat mold do not do what I highlight right there. You have to clean the residue. So when they say, "Hey, this is a super cheap product and a super cheap method for $1,200. We fog your whole building. Your whole school will be fogged. Oh my gosh, it's going to be so clean." You have to say, "Well, what about all the residue?" Now, the downside to you as a buyer, as a purchaser, as a building owner, is that that's a lot of wiping down to do. So when they fog, remember, that fog goes everywhere. And that means the particulates that were in the air are now everywhere. So if you have particulates in the air that you do not want, you have to go wipe them up. And so if you follow the logic from asbestos, it's exactly the same. You know, you don't want those particles getting back in the air. So that adds a lot of complexity, cost, labor, time. So be careful when people are selling you stuff out there. I'm not going to talk about building science. It is very important. Section 4 is remediator qualifications. This is a sticky wicket. And in Ohio, the reason it's a little bit sticky is because we don't have a law, right? No one is out there telling us what a remediator is. You know, we have no federal rules that apply to Ohio with regard to a remediator, and we have no Ohio rules that apply to remediators. If we're doing lead, if we're doing asbestos, if we're doing radon, right? We all can go to the state of Ohio and we can say, "Hey, what do I need to hire one of these guys?" And the state of Ohio very clearly says, "You need a license." And then we can go to the rules for licensing and we say, "What do you need to get a license?" Well, you know, I could just take this right here and just delete it because that does not apply. Again, if someone is telling you in Ohio and actually in, I think in 46 other states, that number might be wrong, there is no licensing requirement. And we just so you know why I mentioned that, we do have national labs out there that are selling laboratory samples, and they're telling people to go hire a licensed remediator, except there's only three or four states that actually have licensing. So they're telling people in all 50 states, find a license. There's no one in Ohio licensed. So if they're telling you they're licensed, they're very confused or they're misrepresenting what they're actually doing out there. I'm not going to talk about things like the different legal, like contractors licensing. I'm not going to touch on that. Training and certification, we do want them to be trained. Certification, again, is not one of those things that we're not really clear on. It seems sometimes it seems there's an endless array of certifications you can get. Training is always questionable. Who's the instructor? The same cert can be taught by three different people, and you can learn three different things, even though the certification to the three students sounds the same. So, we do want a little bit of background from the people that we're hiring. I have no, listen, I have no easy answer for remediator qualifications. I don't have an easy way to answer that. I would tell you, there's a bunch of homework. We can talk about this at another time. We can have another session or something on how to vet and prepare a contract, how to vet remediators. Safety and health, I talked about this. We're gonna literally, that's the section. We push this off completely on OSHA. As a standard for mold remediation, that is not our role, protecting the employees. Section six, pretty long. I am watching the clock. So this can have a whole session all to itself. Contracts are what most of you out there are going to be concerned about. There's a lot, as you can see as I scroll through, there's a lot on doc on cont on contracts. We do have some things that notice I highlighted the word should, that trigger word right there, documents they should maintain. I'm going to scooch by that real fast. We don't have enough time for me to get into this, but notice scope of work, inventory of the contents, activity logs. I boy, can't stress that more. I want to know what they do pretty much every day. Like, what were you doing Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday? Why were you here so long? So those are activity logs. That's what that would apply to. Containment records, and again, I could take that section right there and do a whole class on it. And then we have the recommended documentation. This one right here in the middle is this is questionable. We debated whether or not to put this under a recommend or a should. Personally, for my clients, I tell them this is required. I bump it up to the should, and that is, I want photographs. If I have a remediator on a project, I want him taking pictures before, during, and after. Anytime there's a change, anytime there's something new that's discovered or under or changed, I want pictures. And for a lot of reasons. One, as someone who's my role is often to see the quality control, I want to know what it looked like. On the in addition, we can actually help the process because now they can send us a picture and they can say, "Hey guys, look what we found. What did we do with this wall?" Well, I have a picture of it right now. I can literally assess newly discovered conditions with that photograph or with a short video or something. And so saving those and documenting are very useful. And again, I said it was a little bit of a debate whether or not we're going to make photographs and observations a should or a recommend. And then the same with the evaluation and verification. I'm going to talk about that in a minute. Documentational limitations and deviations. Section eight, and this little section 635 ties you into section eight. Section eight is limitations, complexities, complications, and conflicts. That's a very useful chapter. I don't have time to get into that today, unfortunately, but it really tells you what to do when there's a problem on the project. And we all know, most of us in this room work projects in one fashion or another. There's always a problem, right? There's always a glitch. There's always a surprise. Insurance, again, we can have a whole session on insurance, on what kind of insurance. So if you're a contractor out there and you're curious about insurance, this is a great section for you to take some time out. And if we're hiring people and we want to require the remediator or the contractor to have the right insurance, this is very useful for us. We're running a little bit short. I'm going to pass up this break. I'm going to speed through a couple things. Inspection and preliminary determination. So this is where it gets a little complicated because sometimes we're hiring a mold person to go in and we say, "Hey, Mr. Mold Assessor, go tell us what's in the building. Go do a mold inspection for us." And they come back with a report or a set of samples or something, and they go, "Oh, you got mold on the basement wall. You need to remediate." Well, this is the remediation document, and lo and behold, Section 7 says you have to do an inspection. Well, it's typical with what anybody who runs a business or a contracting business, just like doing windows or roofs or plumbing, you go inspect the work area. You're going to go see what you have. Is there really mold on this wall? Can I see the mold? Can I access it? So the inspection for them is sort of part of that internal assessment process, their scope of work developments, their estimating how much labor, how many materials, things like that. A lot of times we see, especially in Ohio, there is no third-party assessor. There's no third-party inspector. We're hiring somebody who says, oh, we do mold inspections, and oh, by the way, I'll sell you the remediation. That's difficult because of the conflict of interest, right? If the guy selling us the work is also the guy determining where the mold is and what the extent of the mold is there a conflict of interest? That's a whole nother discussion. I'm putting it here as a cautionary tale. Raise a little bit of a red flag. Take a deep breath if you're out there, and the only people you can hire are the same, right? And we define very well in here the difference between an inspection and a preliminary determination. The preliminary determination is critical because it tells the person these four bullets should be identified by the remediator so they can do their job correctly. So the first one is the obvious. Where's the mold growth? The third one is assumptions about contaminated areas, condition two. I'll talk about that in a minute. And then where's the moisture coming in? The fourth one is what I mentioned before about IEPs and health problems. Do we need other specialized experts? Do I need to have someone conduct a third-party assessment? Do I need environmental samples? Contractors by this document are not qualified to collect samples. You have to go to other experts to collect samples. At this time, ICRC does not have a document there. It's underway to define what an IEP is and to define how and where to collect samples or assess a building. There are other documents out there, definitely for another time. Somebody mentioned in that question about work plans. And so when the contractor comes in and he's on the site for the first time and he does this in his own inspection and determination, that information is first for him to develop that work plan. So now, as I said, it's kind of like the estimator, and sometimes that's what they're called. So when we start the project under and or following the S520, this should be done. We should have some information from them. Hey, I did the inspection. I have a preliminary determination. Here's some assumptions. Here's where the water is. We need an engineer to help us because the wall is going to fall down or something like that. So, because that's what specialized experts are for, and they could be anybody. They can be a plumber, waterproofer. And I mentioned this before, remediator qualifications. This is the best we can do. It seems rather generic. Qualified by education, training, and experience. We're going to have some way to interview them and vet them. I put this in blue, again, because it is health, it is outside the realm, and it has to do with health. And we're hearing more and more, we see more and more, we experience more and more contractors, remediators telling us about health. And very clearly, we tell them, do not give advice, education, or warnings outside your area of expertise. Not that they should ignore health. They should take steps to protect health, but they have to avoid that kind of like the diagnosis and treatment. Hey, I have stuff that will make you better. That happens. There is details in here about the inspection process, what we're looking for during the inspection process, some assumptions that can be made. One of the definitions, or two of the definitions that I didn't talk about, were this thing called conditions. And I'm going to do that real quick right here for you. So if you look at this section, mold contamination can be in three different forms. And I'm hesitating because I want to scroll back, but I know there's a lot of pages to scroll back. So when we talk about visible mold and mold remediation, those pictures we saw with the black and the red and the pink and the green and the yellow, that's visible mold growth. We call that condition three. That's the obvious. Almost all of us can agree that that fuzzy stuff on the wall is mold growth, and we need to remove it. The second condition two, is what I often refer to as the invisible condition. And that's because these are things like spores and fragments of the growth. They're different fungal components, as you can see in the yellow right there. They can be part of the mold growth. I mean, they come from mold growth, but if they're removed from the mold growth by some mechanical action, they can land somewhere else. So many people want to tell us they have to bioclean, the bedroom because there was mold in the basement. And what we're saying is prove it, or make an assumption and justify that the invisible stuff in the bedroom needs to be cleaned because it came from the mold in the basement, that condition too. And of course, you can have both three and two. The ceiling's all moldy. There's a really high likelihood that the dust on the floor is some of that mold from the ceiling that's fallen down. The point of clarifying these two things is to highlight what's going to come up soon, is that you can remove condition two by following the S520. You don't need special chemicals. You don't need a special class. You don't need special training. You don't need to pay somebody extra to remove fine particulates like spores and fragments. We're describing that you don't need another standard. This standard covers that. So that in the big picture, that's very critical. I'm going to jump over this. I'm going to go to section nine, which is structural remediation. This is the drywall, the 2x4s, the hardwood floors. We separate, we have a second section on contents. So we do separate out the contents from the structure. And this goes into a lot of detail. This is a really good chapter. We have tools, we have remediation equipment, we talk about air filters, we talk about HEPA vacuums. And I want to point out, we added misting devices for dust suppression. So that would be what we called earlier knockdown. So you can use them for knockdown and dust suppression. We're not using them to apply some sort of disinfectant or biocide or enzyme to destroy the mold. And we clarify that over and over again. And there it is in black and red. And we point out ozone. Ozone's real popular out there. You hear a lot, hey, I have this hydroxyl machine. It's going to generate these invisible hydroxyls. They're super reactive. They'll run around and kill the mold. Guess what? 520 says cannot use them. Remember, should not be used. Should is a must, non-negotiable. So you will not use ozone or hydroxyl devices to attempt to kill the mold. Super, super important, because a lot of our guys that are out there, a lot of these companies out there, they're charging us for this. Well, why should I? If what we're telling you is you don't need these expenses. And so if you're paying for fogs, if you're paying for ozone, if you're paying for hydroxyls, you're just throwing your money away. And that's not what you've been told for years and years and years. You've heard, many of you have heard, this is the way to do it. I got to sell you this. You got to pay for it. And we finally came out in this version. We came out, put our foot down, said, no, we're tired of the nonsense. We're putting it in writing. And now you have something to justify yourself. It's hard to argue with this document. So if some contractor wants to argue with you, or a tenant, or a client, or a building owner, you can say, look, here's the internationally accepted consensus document that tells us what to do. And by the way, we talked about references, and I'll show you the list. We have over 120 references, scientific and regulatory and textbook style references. This isn't just because 14 guys thought it would sound good. We all had to explain and justify where we learned what we learned, and is it justified and backed up and supported by something other than my own personal opinion? My opinion's based on facts. The facts come from these references out there that are very clear, and that the industry knowledge is very much in agreement. This is not us. This is the industry saying, don't waste your money on ozone and hydroxyls, et cetera, et cetera. We talk about containments, isolation areas. We talk about work procedures. I highlighted this because it is something we talked about earlier. Whose responsibility is it to identify and eliminate the moisture sources? That should be done before the job starts, or at least identify that it will be done early or ongoing. And then salvability, that's might be a little bit of a difficult word, but can we actually save this thing? Can we actually remediate it? Can we remove the mold from it? And whether that's a 2x4 drywall or whether it's contents, that should be done. That's a necessary step. This is the first time we get to what is the end result? What's our goal here? And I'm gonna tell you, we're gonna wrap this up in a couple minutes and give you guys a chance. And I'm gonna have to cut it short, but contents has the same caveats, the same limitations, the same requirements as structure. So that's very, very important for you guys to understand. We do not make sweeping generalizations. If it has invisible condition two, if it has invisible spores and invisible mycotoxins, we never say you must throw it out. We say determine whether it's cleanable, determine whether you can remove it. We're saying that these things, spores and mycotoxins, are part of the house dust. They're part of the visible dirt, dust, and debris. So that if I go to 938, how clean does it have to be? 938 cleaning tells us free of visible mold growth, visible dust, visible debris. So I can do like we do in lead, RRP for lead. I can take a white cloth and I can wipe it. I can take a dark blue cloth or a black cloth and I can wipe it. And I can look at those cloths and I can say, oh, look, it's so clean. There's no more dirt on my cloth. That is free of visible dirt, dust, and debris. That has removed the invisible condition, condition two. That has removed and reduced the concentration and contamination of mycotoxins, which you cannot see. Why? Because mycotoxins are part of the dust. They are on a particle of mold, which we define as dust. And so cleaning removes that. And this is that's the phrase right there that's going to help you, because that's your goal. If they can't do that, they are not done. So the guys who fog, the guys who spray, their work area probably still has visible dirt, dust, and debris. And it's easy for you to say, I'm not paying you until this is done. And you walk over there with your hand and a cloth, and you go like this, and you go, look, I just cleaned up dust and I'm paying you to be here because I can see the dust on my cloth. Get out of here. I talked about deviation. I just want you to know it's in here, and we have a lot of information to help you justify why you want to do it some way differently. And if we're asking them to do the 520, they should justify it, and they should put it in writing and explain to us. This is critical. This is the most overlooked thing from every contractor out there, and that is, am I getting a post-remediation evaluation from the contractor? This is different than clearance. If you're doing lead out there, or if you do asbestos, we do this thing called clearance. And clearance is a third-party assessor coming in. It's kind of like a building inspector, right? Oh, my electrical's done. Call the building electrical inspector. However, there should be internal quality controls. That contractor should be able to tell us and document for us that he did his own quality control. And he has determined that his workspace has returned to condition one. Condition one, by the way, is the good condition. That's what we want. That was the pre-loss condition. That was the way the building was before it was damaged by the mold or contaminated by the mold. And we give them these criteria. And this word criteria becomes critically important, because now we can say, I'm paying you to achieve these criteria. If you can't deliver these criteria, not paying you. Or if you can't deliver these criteria, maybe I should find somebody else, or maybe we should call it something different than mold remediation. And really what it is just really good quality control, but it's also knowing what it is you're removing. Like, how clean is clean? And we've said visibly clean. And we even put here, we use this notion of, using a white or black towel, the white glove test, so to speak. We give you that opportunity, and we say can. Remember, I said there's may and can. So can is as possible. So we're explaining in one of the few places in this document, we explain to you how something can be done. And we stay here. At that point, it's probable that structural components and systems have been returned to condition one. And you're going to see that same language in the other chapter, and it's going to say that contents have been returned to condition one. So the same thing applies. I want to wrap this up real quick. We do have a section on verification. That's the third party. I'm not going to talk about HVAC, but we have a whole section there. Here's our, I said we have contents. We have a general he discussion here. Same thing with cleaning methods. It's the same as everything else. It's just all specialized or directed towards contents. And we added some, I don't know if I'm on the right page. We added some terms and we said, look, make sure you can figure out how to clean it. Look at the composition, the assembly, and your ability, your best practices, right? And we put subject matter experts in there for contents because maybe you have a really expensive Oriental rug and you're like, ooh, man, I have this rug, this old Persian rug. It's worth $20,000. Well, don't let the mold guy clean that. Take it to a $20,000 rug expert and let them clean it. You might need to involve a third-party specialist like myself, an IEP or a good industrial hygienist or environmental health specialist, to be able to assess that rug to see how do you clean it? What are we cleaning for? What are we moving? Does it really have mold growth on it, or is it just mold spores, or is it just dust because the dog plays on it? So that all comes into play with contents. Nowhere do we say in this document, and we stand by this, if there's condition two with mycotoxins, you have to throw it out. Nowhere in this document do we say if it's porous, it cannot be cleaned. We've eliminated those concepts. Why? Because they're false. They're selling you false hope, or they're selling you something you don't want to pay for. And we see this right now across the United States, into Canada, into Australia. And we said we got to put a stop to this. So if someone's trying to tell you to throw away all the contents in the house because there's mycotoxins, or that they're impossible to clean, or paper is porous and it absorbs things and you can't clean it, call me. Get this document, quote it, make them explain, because they're talking about something they clearly do not understand, or they don't care to understand, and they're just trying to make money off you. And again, I
Scott,
apologize for being cynical about that.
we have a few questions. I know we're running out of time. Hate to kind of
Not a problem,
interrupt
but
you.
let me, I'm going to show you, we do have sections in here on verification. So there's a whole section on post-remediation verification. That's the third party. And we do have a section in here on an IEP. So when those questions come up, these are available. And just to prove what I said, we actually published the references. And right here are all the documents that we use to inform us during the writing and development of this particular document, 123 of them. So with that, I'm going to stop sharing, and I'm going to thank you, Fred. Thank you, everyone who's attended. We're going to pull up a few questions, and I'm going to give you the yes/no answer unless Fred says I have to give you a longer answer.
That sounds great. Thank you. Hey, Scott, thank you. That was a great presentation. I got a few questions. I'm going to try to run through these and get as many as possible. I think this relates to the contamination removal part in the earlier part of the presentation, where the question is, does physical removal of mold only include mold on the surface of a building material, or should mold contaminated building materials be removed as well? So I think it's about, could I scrape the surface? And I think that's a particularly great question, because there might have been some confusion when you're talking about cleaning and the ability to just check the surface versus what it sounded like earlier. If it's got mold on it, if it's drywall, if it's plaster, if it's underlayment, it needs to go. So if you could elaborate on that.
Yeah, it's, you know what? Thank you for that, because yes, that needs to be clarified. So we use those words salvability and restorability and an ability to remediate. And so we look at any component or content. The way I instruct people to determine salvability, you just froze. Oh, you were just, oh, okay, you didn't. I thought I was worried. I was like, oh my God, did we just like go
No, I'm not
offline?
having a seizure. Fine.
Yeah. Or offline, one of the two.
Yeah.
Thank God you're not having a seizure, though. Although going offline could be just as traumatic as having a seizure. Anyways, what we're trying to do is determine, can we clean it? Can we save it, right? Can we restore it? So really, the way I instruct people this is, we have certain things we have to look at. One, did the thing get wet, right? Is this object wet? So when we talk about porous, we're really saying, did it absorb water? And did the water change that material? Then, because water causes mold growth. So sometimes it's surface water and it doesn't even change the material, right? It's been a light sometimes invisible condensation layer. It doesn't affect the materials whatsoever, and there's mold growth. So we're looking for the mold growth also as the second part of this. Did the mold growth, sometimes mold growth can damage a surface. It can etch something, right? It can etch the paint or etch the stain or the old lacquer or something like that. So sometimes we cannot restore it, or the material is visibly damaged, but it's still structurally sound. I don't need to cut out a two by four if I can remove the mold off the surface. If the two by four is still structurally sound because there wasn't enough water or there wasn't enough microbial fungal digestion, so to speak, right? Because the mold is literally eating, you know, whatever it's sitting on. So there's a combination of things going on. In almost all cases, if the structure of the material is sound, we can clean the mold off of it. There's more to it, but you have to consider it's not a sweeping generalization. You don't say cut out every two by four with visible mold on it. You say, can I clean any of them? Because it's just surface growth, and I can use a rough brush or a rough scrubby or a vacuum or a wire brush, combination of things, and detergent, because detergent removes this stuff from the surface, right? And I don't need any magical chemicals to do it. I just need a good detergent that won't damage that material, right? I can clean artwork, I can clean carpets, I can clean drywall. I've cleaned painted surfaces. I can clean the mold off of a painted drywall. Or sometimes the drywall is damaged because it absorbed water. I got to cut it out. Now, remember, it's up. We need an assessor in here, and we need to do our inspection and determination good, because maybe there's mold on the other side of that wall also. So it gets complicated. I hope that answers that person's question.
It's probably is just a little bit of a follow-up to that from someone. Do you have mold remediation companies follow that plan no matter how much mold there is? For example, a section maybe 6 inches by 6 inches versus a whole wall.
There is in the 520, there is no measure of the assessment or the impact or the risk of exposure. So that is where you need a third party, right? That is where you need a good IEP who does exposure assessment or risk assessment. We do not follow like square foot rules like New York City and EPA for schools and small buildings. They follow square foot rules. When do you build a containment or not? We just say make a determination on how to control, right? We have that thing in there, contaminant control. Remember, it's one of the principles. We say control that. Maybe I can mist it and wet it down with a soapy water, and I can wipe it off. Maybe I can take a vacuum and vacuum it off. I don't need to build a containment, right? And there, when I do health assessment, which is different than 520, I help people do that risk. Like, can I clean the mold off the bathroom wall? Right? It's very common. Like, oh, I got mold on my shower. Well, we clean showers all the time. I don't need a mold remediator to clean the mold off the tile. Well, why do I need a mold remediator to clean the mold off of a concrete wall in a basement if it's the same type of mold and same water problem? Maybe it's not. Bring in a third-party assessor who can help you understand the water, the damage to the materials, and the risk to the occupant.
So next question is, a popular mold cleaner billed as a mold or stain remover is high concentration of hydrogen peroxide in bleach. If applying this is followed by agitation and HEPA vacuuming, is it sufficient for mold removal?
Read the definition of the product again. It had peroxide. Say
It
those
had a high concentration of hydrogen peroxide and bleach. Is applying this followed by agitation and HEPA vacuuming sufficient for mold removal?
Wow, that is a loaded question. Because the first question I have is, why the hell is someone selling a product that has both sodium hypochlorite and hydrogen peroxide in the same damn bottle? So that's my first question. The second question is a little less rhetorical, and it is because maybe they have a chemical reason that they can do that. I doubt it, but I would like to see it explained by the seller. But the other thing is that bottle that you're buying, is it labeled household cleaner? Or is it labeled mold disinfectant? So now we go back to the standard and we say, no, clean it, remove it with soap and water, right? I mean, in generic terms, I'm using a generic term, soap and water. Peroxide's not a soap, it's not a detergent, it's not a surfactant. Bleach, sodium hypochlorites, not a soap, not a detergent, not a surfactant. So why am I using them anyways, right? So the purpose becomes woo. Now, don't get me wrong. Hydrogen peroxide in a correctly prepared formulation enhances cleanability. It does improve cleanability, and we don't have to sell it as a disinfectant. Bleach is strongly oxidative and can be used in the right way to help us remove. However, this notion that I can spray it with peroxide and agitate it and then go vacuum it or wipe it, I would prefer to see the detergent in there. Some people make formulations that include bleaches and detergents and surfactants. Some have peroxides and bleaches and detergents and surfactants. So I always read the whole label, and I want to look at what's the hold and what it says. If it says made to clean, and it has detergents and surfactants in the list, I'm okay with using it most of the time.
Two more questions in here. Why do you think we are missing federal and state standards and regulations, especially curious to this person considering radon, asbestos, and other issues like lead skipped, like this seems to be?
So Fred and I are going to put together another presentation, and we're going to answer that question for you and tell you how to do determination of exposures and risk. And that will answer your question. So the other the brief that's the promo. And
Sounds like a political question there.
it is political, but if you go to the so go to the organizations that would be responsible for helping us write those laws. Go to NIOSH, go to AIHA, go to people at OSHA and EPA, go to ACGIH. So that's a lot of alphabet soup, but right. But just for those out there, those are the professionals like myself. We study, we research, we practice. We know this stuff inside and out. We're a whole bunch of geeks. And we say, how do I do this properly and write a rule? And Florida's tried it. I'll tell you right now, Florida has remediation license rules and remediation assessment rules. And it is one of the most messed up mold assessment remediation states in the country. I work down there. I do jobs down there. I would rather have them have no laws than what Florida ended up with. And New York State, not much better. Texas did a little bit. They were the first ones. They were a little bit better. So you do have three states that have rules. So if you're interested in rules and regulations, go read theirs and talk to people who work there. In Ohio, yeah, absolutely, it's a combination of political, but we also there's a hesitancy, I think, in the regulatory world to regulate something that's difficult to say is one spore, 100 spores, or 100,000 spores bad. In general, Fred, I'm going to take this 1 minute. I'm going to tell the people what I told you yesterday. Fred said, how do we know it's bad? Or how do we tell people it's bad, right? We're there for health. And those of us in this business, we go, look, we're here for the health, right? Health, first and foremost, my job has always been health. I'm a health scientist, environmental health scientist, public health scientist, period. Everything else follows. My building science, my remediation skills, all that follow. Why do we care? Who gives a hoot about mold on a wall in a basement? Well, there's a lot of literature, industry related literature that says damp buildings with mold growth increase the likelihood and increase the complaints of health complaints, increase the number of health complaints. We get sick people in buildings with mold. That's a generic statement. I can guarantee you, if you have mold that's living in a building, it's active, it's sporulating, it's reproducing, doing all those things, and you are in that building long enough, sooner or later, we're going to have occupants that get sick. I don't know who, I don't know when, and I don't know what kind of illness because there's a whole bunch of different symptoms, but guaranteed sooner or later. So we are doing this for health. So that's always our driving factor. Whether or not we can regulate that, that's remains to be seen. And I'm not going to try to debate it here, but the easy word is it's difficult to do.
One more question. Someone asked, how can we get a copy of the S520 of the IICHC standards, which ones would be considered companion standard that we should also reference, such as S500?
That sounds like somebody who's literally working at ICRC and wants me to promote. And it's a fair question, and I kind of skipped over that in the beginning, right? So you can go to the ICRC.org. They sell them online, so you can buy the hard copy. I think I showed you this earlier. You can get one of these, or If you like electronic versions, you can buy a subscription. So you can buy a single document in electronic form available online, and it stays online. I just want to tell you this. They are one of these organizations. You're not buying a PDF. You're buying an online access. So you cannot download the thing. Or you can buy a subscription to all of their standards. So if you want to know how to do carpet cleaning and you want to know how to do hard floor inspections and you want to do water restoration, you want to do mold remediation, you can buy the whole thing, right? You could do trauma cleanup, right? There's a document on trauma cleanup. There's now a document on HVAC systems. But buying the book, it's really up to you. It's personal, but you can order and subscribe online there at IICRC. And it goes by those letters, IICRC, and it'll be .org, and there's a tab on there. And I can't even quote the right prices. I think the book is like 150 bucks. Electronic version is 150, and the entire subscription is like 400 or 500. I forget. I don't know. I'm not a salesman. No
And
clue.
are a number of those companion standards the S500?
Oh, so the 500 is the water restoration. And whether or not you call it a companion or not is really up to you and your business. Those of us who are hiring these people, yes, we should be aware of both the 500 water restoration and the 520 mold remediation. Without doubt, they tie together from my point of view because I'm helping people fix water as well as mold.
Well, that kind of puts us out of time, Scott. You had one more thing to say?
No, one more minute.
Okay, yeah. And I had some more other questions for you. We just didn't have enough time to get to them all. I'm sorry for that, for some of the participants. I will let you know that it is my intent to have Scott involved in some more of our stuff. So there will be more opportunities if he's willing to get more information from him. With that, I want to thank Scott. I want to thank you so much for this great presentation and your perspective that you shared today. I felt this expertise provided a lot of clarity in this space. I want to thank our program committee chair, Carrie Stork, and all the members of our committee for all your hard work in putting this webinar together. I want to thank Ohio in general and Aubrey Jones specifically for supporting this effort and the tech support and the platform to do the webinar. And I want to thank all of you for participating in this webinar and for being our partners in the work that we do to try to ensure that all housing in Ohio is safe, healthy, and affordable. So I want to thank you so much. That pretty much concludes our webinar. Scott is holding up a sign that says Mode Logic with his Substack. Yeah, I'm gonna have
Yes,
to let you
I
explain that.
didn't. I'm taking 10 seconds. 70 people are in the room. Go to moldlogic.substack. Look me up. I have a free blog. You can contact me there. A lot of you had questions. That's the best way to find me. There's, go through there. I have a ton of interesting articles on mold and mold health and building health. So go there. Mycotoxins, attic mold, HVAC filters, tons of stuff is on there right now. And it's a great way to reach out and contact me. So Mold Logic. I also have Mold Logic on Facebook, but it's a horrible, I don't even monitor the page. But moldlogic.substack.
And once again, remember if you're applying for CEs, email Philip Bouton at PBOUTON at columbus.gov, and we'll take care of it. He will need your full name, your blanking on the acronym, your RS, your REHS number. And we will get that to you. Once again, thanks everybody for being a part of this. And that concludes our webinar. Thank you so
Thanks,
much. Thanks,
everybody.
Scott.